Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name is John, and with me as always is Steve. How are you doing?
John, how's it going?
Good. You know, I've never bought a house in my life and I have no interest in ever doing that. I'd rather live in a hotel.
I'd like
the Coco Chanel style and just die in a hotel room.
Well, that's the life you want. But for us peasants, I've actually bought two places. I bought a condo like 7 years ago, and then I bought a house about 3 years ago. And it was a pain in the neck. All the paperwork.
Really?
Yes, just
that's what I imagine.
Horrendous.
That's one of the things that always scared me away. Also, the just traveling around the world wherever I want would be pretty awesome too. Right. You know, whenever you see a pain point, you think there's a business opportunity. And if we were smart enough, we would have jumped on that. But fortunately, we do have two guys on the podcast this week who are smart enough to jump on this opportunity. We have Josh Feinblum and Costa Ligris, the co-founders of Stavi. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, guys. Well, thank you for having us. Excited to be on the podcast and hear more about your adventures as living as the alter ego to Coco Chanel, living out of a hotel room.
Dare to dream.
It's exciting to be here. And it's funny because, you know, we obviously talk with a lot of people around the community, and it's clear that that you guys are a fun time. And hopefully one day we'll get to meet in person.
Yeah, for sure. That'd be fun.
Be awesome, yeah.
You guys are facilitating the mortgage world. Steve, why don't you tell us your bit of experience and we can kind of jump off from there.
Sure. So maybe about 10 years ago or so, I bought a condo in DC where I used to live. And I had, you know, you have all these accounts. You have a brokerage account. You have a checking account. You have to provide source of funding. It was basically, I had to basically collate all my information from multiple sources and then wait about 40 days or so, which is a very, very slow process. It was a little better the second time that I did it when I bought a house here in California. But that was also kind of a slow process with, again, a lot of paperwork, a lot of wedding signatures, which really is just astounding that in 2017 or so, we're still doing wedding. But let's just say that it wasn't exactly a dynamic, super fast, super easy process. And I'm so glad that we have companies like Stavi now to help us with these gigantic pain points that you see as a homeowner. And I can only imagine also the value prop that you see from the other side as either the originator or the title company or basically all the other players in this space.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. So this is Josh, and Costa and I met at business school about 5 years ago. And Costa at the time was running a law firm that he had founded about 20 years ago now, which is one of the largest real estate transaction firms in New England. And, you know, I was buying a home for the first time in almost a decade in 2017. And going through the process, I was, there was a journalist that used a very good term that I need to remember what that word was. But I was being very vocal about how the process had gotten worse in the last decade. And it was almost a year later when I was at Costa's brother's house on Christmas Eve. And Costa's like, you remember how you complain a lot about this? Like, I want to start a company that makes this better. I've been working on this on the side. And do you want to do it with me? I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, this is, you know, when we were talking about it, even a couple years ago, we know that this is going to be a different experience for buyers and needs to be a different experience for buyers and sellers and pretty much everybody in between. You know, it was just hard for us to say, is this a change that's coming, you know, 3 years from now, 6 years from now? We kind of tongue in cheek say we know it's going to be different in 10 years, but it's just way too complicated. It's too burdensome on every party involved, and it's too burdensome on the environment. So I think your observation is one that pretty much everybody that's gone through the process would echo and share.
Yeah. So basically, you know, Stavi's core product is to take what has traditionally been transactions that have required a tremendous amount of paper and in-person meetings and move them into a digital platform. And so the platform supports electronic signatures, electronic or remote notarization, the secure exchange of documents back and forth, and a video session where the notary and or relevant stakeholders associated with the transaction can meet securely and have a session where they can share documents, explain documents, capture signatures and notarizations all in one secure platform with an audit trail and a recording as necessary to comply with the regulatory framework.
What is the genesis of this and how did you get into the industry? You mentioned that you came from the legal profession before?
My background, I'm a med school dropout that went to law school to be a patent lawyer for biotech and pharma. I graduated at an interesting time when the dot-com bubble burst and had to quickly reinvent myself. I had been renting apartments as a side hustle to try to help mitigate some of the cost of tuition, and so had been exposed to the real estate space. So when the time came to reinvent myself, I found myself sort of interested in building title and settlement operations. And so that's how I got into the real estate space. I always joke around with people that people don't end up in real estate, title, and settlement. No kid says, I want to grow up and be a mortgage banker, or I want to grow up and be a title agent or an escrow officer. We all kind of, like, you know, life has its way of getting us into the space. And then just like the true the quote from The Godfather, you know, once you get out, they just keep pulling you back in. And so I've been in the space now for over two decades.
I really am a what I call a lifelong technologist. I started writing code when I was about 10. And then within a couple of years of that, I got involved in what we now call the cybersecurity community. It was definitely not called that in the 90s. I don't know what we would have called ourselves, a bunch of different names. And I spent about 25 years in the security, trust and safety, fraud and abuse, privacy world. But, you know, the broader genesis was working within and building, you know, large technical teams and operational teams to deal with, you know, large scale complicated problems. And so, you know, I personally knew I was itching to do things beyond security. And, you know, what I really liked about it when Costa and I first started talking about it is, you know, obviously the security and the compliance obligations around the space that we're in, as well as, you know, the risks if fraud starts to occur in this environment are so great that it was really a perfect opportunity for me individually to get out of the, you know, being a security practitioner and, you know, move, you know, more into the entrepreneurial world while still being able to use the background that I had, you know, along the way.
You know, and I'm always curious, and I think people who haven't got their company off the ground yet kind of maybe wonder, how do they get somebody to trust them with you're doing such a key, risky, a lot of compliance, security, of course, issues with the back end of someone's operations. It's not like you can just say, oh, we'll do it for you for free, because they have to integrate what you do into their process, which is kind of a big leap, big trust factor. So how did you guys manage to get your foot in the door in those first few places, get somebody to trust you when you hadn't done that business before exactly?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, you know, there's a lot baked into that question. The first is this notion that what we're doing is less secure. As it stands today, the way the industry works is almost startlingly unsafe, where lenders are, you know, sending, you know, enormous amounts of personal information to title companies and settlement agents. And, you know, sometimes they're doing it in ways that are a little bit safe. And other times they're doing it ways that are just obviously unsafe. And, you know, there's this place in the in between, which is, you know, they're trying to do it safely, but the way that the vendors that they're sending these orders to are handling that process in a very unsafe way. So, you know, as it stands today,
part of the pitch is like, you can't be doing worse than what you do now.
I don't like to phrase it that way, but that's very, very, very true. And
your security background kind of helps with that a bit. Yeah,
it certainly does, because, you know, the companies that I've been at and the roles that I've been in, when we're engaging with the compliance and security teams across the board, you know, we know the language that they speak. We know what they're going to be worried about, which both allows us to answer the questions well. But more importantly, from the beginning, we started really building out our processes and technology in a way that is safe and that thinks about the concerns that these stakeholders are going to have. But when you think about these types of transactions, I mean, right now, if you're going and you're entering court to dispute one of these transactions, you're going to go find the notary that did the transaction 6 years ago, and they're going to open up their notarial journal and say, yeah, I was there. And, you know, they're not going to remember anything else about that transaction, right? So when we're and this is kind of one discrete example across many things that we do, when you're going through a transaction on our platform, that video is being recorded. There's multiple things beyond just looking at like a physical ID that we're doing to validate the identity of the principals involved in the transaction. And so, you know, from a fraud perspective, that it makes it much more difficult for somebody to argue what was said, how things were explained to them, whether it was them or not, whether they were coerced, because the entire transaction is recorded. And that's really a really important distinction where, you know, there's pros and cons to that, but, you know, there really isn't an outcome where somebody can say, hey, like, it wasn't me that signed this document, because we're gonna have a video, a non-reputable video of the transaction.
That's bad news for me then. I can't deny anything.
Yeah.
And they told you what that adjustable rate mortgage meant.
Yeah. No, I've seen, maybe it just got more press, but you know, the fraud that goes on with a lot of mortgages, even simple things like somebody giving you, getting the information somehow and having you wire money to a criminal instead of instead of through the mortgage transaction.
Yeah. I mean, in previous lives, I'd spent a lot of time interacting with predominantly federal law enforcement when they're dealing with this type of, I don't even want to call it fraud. I just want to call it theft. And I mean, it's an exponentially growing area of crime. And but one of the reasons that this happens is because when you're going through the transaction, I mean, you've got a title company communicating with you, you've got an appraiser communicating with you, you've got, you know, your loan officer, you've got, you know, somebody in loan processing, maybe the closing department, maybe the settlement agent, and they're all communicating with you different ways, right, as a borrower. And so when you get an email from somebody that looks legitimate, or if, you know, somebody in the process had like an email account hacked, this notion that you're going to, you know, wire money as you're instructed, you know, it's very, when you kind of unpack why that fraud type of fraud is happening, it's actually easy to see why it's so successful. And the only way that we can really, I mean, there's a lot of ways. One of the key things that we need to do to start, you know, reducing the efficacy of that type of crime is by training everybody involved in the transaction that there is a specific way that you're going to hear from us. And there, you know, if you're hearing from us in any other capacity or anyone involved in the transaction, you need to be very skeptical. You know, but the process, because of how fragmented it is today and how complicated it is today, it's very easy for people to, using various tactics, you know, trick people into sending money to inaccurate bank accounts.
Yeah, it's also, I think that it's a lot more common in the industry because as a title company, you usually have a much smaller footprint. Maybe you don't have good cybersecurity. And as you say, they're more prone to getting, you know, phishing attacks or something so that people can get access to their email. I actually had a friend here in Oakland who was going through the process of closing on a house, rather expensive house, and got an email from their title agent saying basically wire this money to this account. And he, because he was delayed, whatever, he mentioned it to his wife. His wife actually ended up calling the company. They said, no, that's not us. We were hacked. But he saved himself what could have been a several hundred thousand dollar mistake because this company, again, had very lax security. And that's something that you find. It's sort of the weak point in the transaction is the smaller companies as opposed to, say, the bank or something like that. So it's definitely a huge issue that kind of if this underreported.
And this goes back to the very, very premise of the question that you asked. How do we get people to trust us? Right. Right now, lenders are making a decision to trust, you know, dozens and dozens of those title agents. Right. Some might do a great job, you know, and really focus on security. Others might be using, you know, their AOL account with the same password they use to log into every e-commerce site on the planet and no two-factor authentication. Yeah. Right. So the lender has no way of knowing. And even if they're using something like secure email, if we're lucky, you know, there's somebody still would have access to that link. And the person that's registering the account on the secure email system is probably using the same password they've used for that AOL account. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, being able to have a system like Stavi that enforces two-factor authentication for all of its users has some degree of password complexity requirements. Just inherently is going to, not only make it harder for that type of fraud to occur, but also it's going to protect, this incredibly sensitive information that exists today in the email inboxes of, dozens of title companies per lender.
Great. And also on the, during the COVID-19 crisis, I understand that you also partnered with a company called Flagstar Bank to help homeowners stay in their bank by basically streamlining the process. How did that come about, and what actually are you doing with that?
Yeah, so it's interesting, understanding the servicing side of residential mortgages is an interesting opportunity. And so the SVP of loss mitigation and default at Flagstar heard us pitch to a Flagstar accelerator program that they were running to look at innovations and innovators in the mortgage tech space. And although we were very focused on origination and fulfillment of originated loans and home equity lines and refinances, they essentially looked at the opportunity and said, well, we have a use case where we can use the tools on the loss mitigation side. And so, for users that may or may not be familiar with it, loss mitigation essentially is this process where you're trying to mitigate, obviously, the loss and looking at solutions to keep borrowers in their homes. And there's different types of scenarios that are the outcome of that. And so a bank has to underwrite the scenario and see that the modification, whatever that may be, whether it's lowering the rate, changing payment terms, adding the payment that has payments that have not been made to the tail end of the loan as part of a payoff or as a balloon payment at the end, it has to be underwritten. And there is a process around that depending on what kind of loan it is and whether it's a loan owned by Fannie and Freddie or serviced or and owned by somebody else. But then there's actually the consummation of sort of like a mini closing, if you will, where the modification documents have to be signed and notarized to effectuate that modification. And so Stavi is able to step in our partnership with Flagstar, something that we're really excited about. We'll soon be announcing a second servicer coming onto the platform as well. And what's interesting about it is we're taking what has traditionally been a 20, 30, 40 day process of sending a consumer a paper package with little post-it notes, sign here, initial here, date here,
oh, yeah,
and notarize here. Go find your own notary and send it back to us. And we've taken that down to about 24 hours, being able to schedule it both digitally, do the section completely online, capture the signatures, and keep the document in electronic format through its entire life cycle.
Interesting. And no, it seems like this is kind of the kind of use case that could benefit from an immutable technology like blockchain. Is that something that you guys have also explored using blockchain to maybe run some of these processes?
There's various places where distributed ledger technology has potential to be beneficial. I think there's we could certainly use blockchain in various places, but we don't want to just use it so we can say we use it. I think where we get a lot more interested in distributed ledger is when we start thinking about promissory notes, things where there's like multiple interested stakeholders that hold an interest in the note that need such a high degree of reliability that requires such a high degree of reliability in that document, understanding where it came from, understanding where it's been. That's where distributed ledger is really going to accelerate in this space, in my opinion. So we've certainly explored it, but there's sometimes just using a good old fashioned database is the right way to do things with technology.
It's interesting. So people, obviously you can't really talk about innovation in real estate without people really sort of probing on the question of the use of distributed ledger technology. It's certainly something that when you look at it from a use case, it seems like such a natural fit. The challenge is that we're still dealing with stakeholders through the process, which are banks and insurance companies that are conservative. They are slow to adopt new technology. And so we're still in places where we're trying to get them to adopt and accept e-signatures and things that have been around for quite some time. And I think it's one of those concepts of, unfortunately, we're certainly moving faster in the space, but we're still not moving fast. And incremental innovation, is the key here. And we're just not ready in a lot of these instances to be able to convince these stakeholders to move from, pen and paper and in-person transactions all the way to a distributed ledger technology, we have to absorb and be willing to help them sort of crawl before they walk, before they run. And I'm not saying that they're necessarily just crawling now. There are certainly lenders that are walking at full stride and step, but it is something that, you know, we're mindful of and we're watching, but we just don't feel that the opportunity is there for massive adoption yet.
Sure, sure. So congratulations, by the way. You completed your Series A round, $40 million. So a lot of growth and expansion coming up. How did the process go?
I think, fundraising is always an interesting thing for founders. Josh and I have had a lot of perspectives, having been involved, in that ecosystem from a very granular perspective, both, having done angel investing, having looked at deals for venture funds and reviewed potential memorandums on investments. And, that certainly helps because we have a network of people that we can trust and give us guidance and advice through the process. I think that, generally speaking, it's never an easy thing. It's kind of funny. I was talking to a colleague who teaches at MIT, where Josh and I went to school, and she was like, "Oh, congratulations." I was like, "I love it when people congratulate me for giving up a piece of my company." And, always a fun comment to have. But the reality is, when you're undertaking difficult things and you're doing tough, taking on tough initiatives, it requires capital. It requires a robust, team. And that requires, significant investment. I think the process is always interesting. It is an opportunity to self-reflect in terms of what you're interested in doing and what the next goals are for the growth of the organization. We're fortunate to have remarkable investors that are very passionate and disciplined and see the vision and understand that this is not an overnight process and appreciate that. And I think, for the most part, we were really well received in the marketplace, even to the point where, honestly, frankly, I think, we actually had to eventually shut down this round. This started as a much smaller round, but we realized that there was an opportunity to do a larger round and have a bigger war chest to be able to create impact. And we're excited and blessed to be able to do that. And now, the hard work continues, and it's what I think most founders will tell you. The one thing that they're not, that they don't love doing is raising money, because it is a distraction. And yeah, what we love doing is rolling up our sleeves and building building our team and building our products.
Yeah, and you have a few more resources for that. So a lot of the money will go into technical hires and building up the capabilities?
The money is going to go into a whole host of different hires. We've, for the most part, filled up most of our leadership team, and we're excited to have some really remarkable leaders from both within the ecosystem and outside the ecosystem, bringing a fresh and diverse perspective. But technical hires, product hires, additional support hires, go-to-market and sales hires, and more people in our marketing and communications team. We're also allocating some resources towards R&D.
Yeah, well, you're still pretty young, even for a fintech. You just had your second anniversary, right?
We did. Josh and I celebrated our 2-year anniversary this summer when this started off for the two of us sort of sitting in Kendall Square in sublease space that a venture fund that we have a relationship with was gracious enough to let us squat and sort of standing there looking at each other, trying to figure out what was next. That was our version of like two guys in a garage.
Two guys in a nice small office in Kendall Square. I mean, not quite the same, but same emotions, staring at each other, being like, okay, now we're here. What do we do next?
The espresso machine was a little bit dated. sometimes they didn't have the cream I liked.
Yeah, I mean, like the bevy ran out of one of our favorite flavors. It was very stressful.
It's a tough life. People offering you too much money for your rounds. Oh, I really, really feel for you guys.
Yes.
I mean, any entrepreneur will tell you there's a great deal of stress,
sure.
Unpredictability, but it's funny because the emotions of us sitting in that office and seeing where we were then, which was really, I mean, probably we had been working together on it for about 6 months before we joined full time. But then, it's easy to advise companies on it. It's easy to proffer opinions from the outside about what people are working on and how they're structuring it. It is fascinatingly different, you know, to be two guys, you know, sitting in a room trying to figure out, you know, what you do next to make something that doesn't exist turn into something that not only exists, but is something people will buy into, prospects, employees, investors. And it's a journey.
Well, it sounds like you guys had some experience with seeing what works and what doesn't work and had some perspective. So that must have helped you feel confident about this opportunity.
I think the short of it is that, yes, you know, no matter how many times you've seen it, though, to Josh's point, it becomes very personal when you're doing it yourself. I think people don't appreciate that, you know, there's the concept of raising capital. There's the concept of raising capital from the right groups and people. And then there's the actual execution. And it is it's an overwhelming process, and it always takes its respective stress and toll on founders, because there is a lot of pressure to perform. And the reality is that, you know, with the feedback of the market, you know, you determine what your round is. But ultimately, what it really boils down to is you have a responsibility to your investors, and that responsibility is once you raise that money. You have a responsibility to execute and deliver to the best of your ability. And along with that comes pressure, and it comes, you know, sleepless nights, as Josh says. And it's very different to be an outsider making recommendations on investments for things that you can not necessarily have an ownership interest in. And so it's interesting. It's, you know, it's required to be able to build things at scale. It's part of the process, but it doesn't necessarily make it easier.
Sure. Yeah. Even minor things, you stress about, you know, your investment portfolio going up and down 0.5%. And this is your whole life, on the other hand. So,
well, I mean, more important, because yeah. You said something that's more important than it being our lives. The reason it becomes personal is, one, you're asking people to invest in you. Sometimes people that, you know, love and trust, but then you're asking people, some who you know, some who you don't, to, you know, leave a job, right? And then come work for your company, right? And you know, like, there is, even if you're the senior most leader at a company that has been around for 4 or 5 years, and is like, you know, there are these repeatable processes, there are these things that exist that you can have confidence in, and you know, it is an emotionally taxing experience. You know, when you realize that people are now joining your vision and trusting you in a way that's different, even at slightly larger or more mature companies, even where we are today. And I'd say the one other thing that, you know, I don't know that I hear people talk about it a ton is, you know, Costa and I were both, you know, like we did well and we were pretty respected in the industries that we were in. Hopefully, you know, maybe not by everybody, but, you know, I think
as far as you know.
Yeah, as far as I know, and when you get to those positions, you're not used to people saying no, right? You know, like if you're offering a job to someone, by the time they get to you, they're generally pretty excited. There's a good chance they're gonna convert. If you have an idea, right? Like, but once you kind of become this early stage entrepreneur, right? I think the biggest shift is you just have to get used to rejection, right? It almost has to turn into something that motivates you. Because everybody says no.
Oh, then I'm really ready for this then. I should really make the jump. No, but you make up. Yeah, that's some very good points about the responsibility and, you know, and yeah, it's not just you, it's other people's careers and money. So you've had a great start. I mean, this is a very good scenario from 2 years ago to end up in, it looks like. So what are some of the obstacles to moving ahead, to growing out the company?
I think the first thing is obviously what I was chatting about earlier, which is, you know, we are still in the early innings of digital innovation in the space. And so what that essentially means is, you know, I think we're starting to see the adoption of traditional institutions, financial institutions and banks and non-bank lenders really embrace partnerships with fintechs. And it's, you know, sort of interesting to see how that evolves over time, But the challenge still exists that there is a tremendous amount of fragmentation in the space. There are incumbent legacy technology and software providers that are sometimes difficult to partner with or difficult to replace any component of what they do. And so there is a process here of really appreciating, you know, what is the value that your customers want and how do you get there? And when you look at the world, especially of lending, you have your larger lenders. And in many cases, they understand the resources necessary to be able to deploy large technical deployment or new software and new projects. But, you know, the majority of lending in this country happens by small and medium-sized lenders. And they typically don't have the resources internally to be able to vet out and deploy and train infrastructure. And so they need to be, you know, in many instances, you need to be a partner, which is something that we're really focused and obsessed around, which is not just being a, you know, somebody that sells something off the shelf, but partnering with our customers to be able to help them vet the process, vet their options and solutions, and then be able to help them deploy and make them successful. And that takes time and it takes discipline. And so, you know, our cost of customer acquisition, when you're selling to those types of institutions where it requires high touch and a lot of attention, is high. And it requires a lot of handholding. And in many instances, we're teaching our customers how to buy not just our technology, but how to buy technology and move from something that they've been doing for decades into a digital world. And that comes along with its challenges. And, you know, there's no secret that fintechs, especially early stage fintechs, challenged to get the attention of larger financial institutions for a variety of reasons. You know, they're concerned about risk, they're concerned about, you know, support and so on and so forth. And so, you know, as an ecosystem, I think, you know, you're seeing now larger institutions, you know, really go on the record and say, we need to figure out ways to be able to partner with fintechs. They're agile, we move fast, we move, you know, we're very innovative. And so as a result, there's a lot of value in partnering there and being able to assess the risk, but, you know, de-risk it as best as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, more efficient and secure and so many benefits. It sounds like if I ever do buy a place, I hope they're using Stavi then.
I sure hope they do for your sake.
Yeah. I don't want all the pain for sure. Thanks a lot for joining us on the podcast. Keep up the good work.
Thank you for having us. We're excited to be on here and to share our story. And hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Yeah, for sure. Before your initial coin offering or IPO or SPAC or direct listing.
We're going to do all three of those things at the same time.
I'm sure the SEC won't have any issue with an ICO and IPO at the same time. It'll be great. Yeah. We'll be the first.
And a spec. Yes.
Coastal looks great in orange, by the way.
No, I'm not good with orange or stripes. I look fat.
Well, yeah, I guess you know what it looks like.
I was a criminal lawyer for 6 months.
Yeah. I'm surprised I haven't met you then before. All right. Thanks. Thanks again for joining us. That's Costa Ligris and Josh Feinblum, the co-founders of Stavi. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. And thank you for listening.